Those who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Dasha, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the Friday, November 7th issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In news in the U.S., the jury finds that the sandwich assault didn't cut the mustard. By C. Ryan Barber. A man who became an internet sensation after throwing a Subway sandwich at a federal agent was acquitted on Thursday of assault, the latest defeat for prosecutors in cases stemming from the Trump administration's law enforcement surge. It took jurors a day to reach their verdict in a case that required them to decide whether Sean Dunn's hurling of a footlong at a U.S. Border Patrol agent's chest constituted a misdemeanor criminal offense. The charge turned in part on questions of whether the sandwich toss could have reasonably caused bodily harm. His lawyers argued that the throw was a harmless gesture directed at an officer in a ballistic vest that punctuated an outburst in which Dunn condemned President Trump's law enforcement takeover of Washington. They noted that the sandwich remained largely intact after impact, resulting in little more than mustard on the officer's uniform and onion hanging on his radio antenna. Prosecutors argued that antipathy to Trump's policies doesn't confer the right to throw objects at law enforcement officials.
When we have disputes, we settle them verbally. We don't let them turn physical,
Justice Department lawyer John Perrin told the jury. Dunn's viral moment came on August 10th, when he was captured in a widely shared video yelling at a group of officers outside of a Subway in a busy nightlife corridor of Washington. After berating them for several minutes, he threw the sandwich at close range. The video was played in court, with the Border Patrol agent testifying he could feel the impact of the sandwich through his protective vest. Dunn, who had been a Justice Department employee, was fired soon after the incident. Upon hearing the verdict, Dunn embraced his three defense lawyers, while the presiding judge thanked jurors for their service.
I'm relieved, and I'm looking forward to moving on with my life, he told reporters.
Department leaders had trumpeted Dunn's arrest and prosecution, with Attorney General Pam Bondi calling him an example of the deep state we have been up against for 7 months. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, whose office brought the case, told Dunn in a video posted on social media to stick your Subway sandwich somewhere else. On Thursday, Pirro said she accepted the verdict. Before trial, prosecutors had faced complications getting an assault charge to stick. In late August, a grand jury declined to indict Dunn on a felony charge of assaulting, resisting, or impeding a federal officer, defying the adage the grand jury so easily sign off on charges that one could, quote, indict a ham sandwich. The Justice Department then opted to downgrade their case against Dunn to misdemeanor assault, a charge that didn't require a grand jury. Full SNAP benefits must be provided, judge says, by Lydia Wheeler. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to fully fund food assistance benefits for November by Friday, criticizing the government's efforts so far to make payments during the government shutdown. Judge John McConnell said the administration violated the order he issued last week that required the government to tap emergency funds and expeditiously pay benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. The government said it would use $4.65 billion in a contingency fund to allow for the partial payment of November benefits, but warned it could take several weeks or months for states to make that reduced payments. It declined to use other funds to make up the shortfall, arguing that such a move would deprive other important programs of money. McConnell chided the government during a hearing on Thursday for its actions.
People have gone without for too long. Not making payments to them for even another day is simply unacceptable, said the judge, an Obama appointee.
He directed officials to release the full funding to states for November benefits by Friday. SNAP benefits, which cover roughly 42 million Americans, typically total about $8 billion a month. Since the contingency fund wouldn't cover the full amount, he ordered them to use another source of money to make up the shortfall. McConnell quoted President Trump's social media post in which he said, quote, SNAP payments will be given only when the government opens, end quote. The White House later clarified that the government would comply with the court order and said the president was referring to future payments. The judge said the consequence of the administration's actions was, quote, harm to families, elderly, children, and others that cannot be undone. Job losses rise sharply in 2025 by Harriet Torrey. Employers said they have cut more than 1 million jobs so far this year, a sharp rise in job losses from the same period last year, according to a report released Thursday. The report, from consulting firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas, tracks job losses each month. Investors and policymakers are relying heavily on data from private sources, since government data that tracks jobs is on hold during the shutdown. Through October, employers reported cutting 1,099,500 jobs, an increase of 65% from the first 10 months of last year, and 44% more than the 761,358 cuts announced in all of 2024. In October alone, U.S. companies' job cut announcements nearly tripled from the September figure to 153,074 from 54,064. Companies cited cost cutting and artificial intelligence, the consulting firm said. In Capital Count by Greg Ipp, why tariffs are in peril at the high court. Lawyers often stretch the facts to make their case, but even so, this was quite the howler from U.S. Solicitor General John Sauer in defense of President Trump's tariffs at the Supreme Court on Wednesday.
They are not revenue-raising tariffs.
Excuse me? Of course they are. Revenue is why Trump loves tariffs. For years, he has dreamed of charging other countries for the privilege of selling to the U.S. He has boasted of the cash his tariffs have raised, how they could replace the income tax, finance farmer bailouts, and maybe fund tariff rebate checks. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who attended Wednesday's session, has extolled tariffs' contribution to deficit reduction. So, why was Sauer arguing otherwise? Because the Constitution assigns authority to raise revenue via tariffs and other taxes to Congress. By claiming that Trump's rationale is quite different from what he's actually said, Sauer hoped to persuade the Supreme Court to let the tariffs stand. More than these particular tariffs are at stake, so is a bedrock principle of American governance. The framers gave legislators the power of the purse to ensure the president couldn't acquire the dictatorial powers of a king. That principle has been eroding for generations as the imperial presidency has encroached on Congress. It went into overdrive this year as Trump arbitrarily extracted money or equity from companies needing favors from the federal government, withheld appropriated funds from universities, states, and others, and effectively defunded statutorily created agencies such as USAID and the Education Department out of existence. The conservative-dominated Supreme Court put limits on some of President Joe Biden's actions, but it hasn't done so yet for Trump. Philosophically, it tends to see the president's authority over foreign policy or the executive branch quite broadly. But even for this court, allowing any president to impose the largest tax increase since 1982, $3.9 trillion over a decade, Trump's own budget office estimates, without any input from Congress, may be a bridge too far. At one point, Justice Neil Gorsuch said, "The really key part of the context here is that the constitutional assignment of the taxing power to Congress, the power to reach into the pockets of the American people, is just different, and it's been different since the founding." The case is superficially narrow and technical. Trump has raised tariffs on almost every country to rates as high as 100%, invoking the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act. The law allows the president to regulate imports to counter emergencies originating abroad. Trump claims regulate goes beyond the tools presidents usually use, such as sanctions, to tariffs. His opponents say Congress didn't intend the law to authorize tariffs, noting that numerous other statutes do, for example, to address the trade deficit or unfair trading practices. Lower courts have ruled against Trump. Trump argues tariffs are a logical tool to carry out foreign policy, like embargoes and sanctions, which fall more squarely under the president's sole purview. That's why Sauer sought to sever the connection to revenue.
The fact that they raise revenue is only incidental. The tariffs would be most effective, so to speak, if no person ever paid them, because they would have achieved their goal of changing another country's behavior or diverting all American purchases away from imports to domestic goods, he said. Yet, Trump regularly undermines these rationales, recently telling CBS's 60 Minutes that the U.S. doesn't want to make some of the products he's tariffed, such as underwear. He's lowered but not eliminated tariffs on countries that struck deals. It isn't the mere fact of the tariffs that upsets the constitutional order, but their magnitude and breadth. Opponents argue they violate two principles key to the separation of powers. Under the major questions doctrine, presidents may not read authority with broad economic or political ramifications into a statute without clear guidance from Congress. Under the non-delegation doctrine, Congress may not cede its legislative duties to anyone else. Sauer argued neither applied in this case, as Trump's tariffs fall under his power to steer foreign policy, a presidential duty. But the court wasn't buying it. Trump is using power to impose tariffs on any product from any country in any amount for any length of time. It does seem like that's a major authority, Chief Justice John Roberts said. His vehicle is imposition of taxes on Americans, and that has always been the core power of Congress. Justice Elena Kagan said, a tax with no ceiling, a tax that can be anything that here the president wants, there an agency wants, would raise a pretty deep delegation problem. The hearing suggests at least six of the nine justices, the three liberals, Roberts, Gorsuch, and Amy Coney Barrett, are ready to uphold the lower court's decision and rule against Trump. Trump has claimed this would, quote, literally destroy the United States of America, end quote. That doesn't seem likely. He would lose some revenue, but not all, because some tariffs were imposed under authorities not at issue in this case. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget estimates $90 billion of the $195 billion collected so far is at risk. Going forward, Trump could recapture lost revenue with other tariff authorities. This might constrain his negotiating leverage, but not by much. The more important consequence is for American governance. Trump has built his agenda from tariffs to deportations to attacks on alleged Venezuelan drug runners on largely unchecked presidential authority. Should he prevail in this case, he could raise almost any sort of tax simply by invoking an emergency with some foreign connection, however tenuous. A future president could declare a climate emergency and impose a carbon tax. As Gorsuch noted, Congress could, practically speaking, not get these powers back, since that would require a two-thirds majority in both chambers to override the president's inevitable veto. It's a one-way ratchet toward the gradual but continual accretion of power in the executive branch and away from people's elected representatives, Gorsuch said. The justice's message Wednesday? It may be time to stop. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In U.S. news, state Republicans say no to Trump. In a direct break with the president, many are rejecting his call to kill the filibuster. President Trump has picked the one fight with the Republican-led Senate that he might not be able to win. All year, Republican senators have mostly managed to find their way to yes when Trump asked, blessing everything from controversial nominees to tariffs to foreign strikes.
Most recently, the president has doubled down on his demand that GOP senators do away with their chamber's longtime filibuster rule to bypass Democrats and end the record-setting government shutdown. But many Republicans are saying no for now, with implications for Trump's agenda. It also marks the most direct break GOP senators have made with the White House during his second term in office. At breakfast on Wednesday with Republican senators at the White House, Trump had made a case on live TV that doing away with the filibuster's 60-vote threshold was the only way to end the record-breaking impasse. He also said it would help Republicans, who have a 53-47 majority in the Senate, win next November by enabling them to move bills along party lines to restrict mail-in voting and require voters to present identification before casting ballots. The change would also open the door for Republicans to pass any number of contentious bills this Congress that the filibuster or threat of filibuster has blocked. Trump warned Republicans that resisting would be a tragic mistake, arguing that Democrats would eliminate it anyway if Republicans didn't act first. It was a tough sell. The filibuster is an especially sensitive issue for senators. Many see it as a critical tool that differentiates the Senate from the House and ensures the minority party's concerns are taken into account. And while ending the filibuster would pay off immediately for Republicans now, they would be frozen out if Democrats won back the Senate. As Trump urged lawmakers to change the rule, the cameras panned to show Senate Majority Leader John Thune, Republican of South Dakota, who has promised to defend the filibuster, listening to Trump's argument with no expression. Once the media left, Trump continued his pitch, said one senator who attended the breakfast. But the president didn't demand a vote to get rid of the filibuster, and Thune's not going to do it unless he's pushed, the senator said. Back at the Capitol later that day, Republican senators mostly dug in. Some declined to say how they would vote personally, but emphasized there weren't enough Republican votes to kill the filibuster. Other GOP lawmakers were adamant they would never flip from to yes from no, even if they understood Trump's argument. He's not a member of the Senate, so I don't begrudge him for trying to nuke the filibuster, Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, said of Trump. I am a member of the Senate. There are reasons why I don't think it's a good idea. We're not going to do that, said Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, the former Senate Republican leader who brushed off Trump when the president pushed him to nuke the filibuster during his first term. It takes 51 votes to change or kill the filibuster. Opposition from four GOP senators would be enough to preserve the rule if all Democrats voted no. In recent interviews with the Wall Street Journal, 15 Senate Republicans pledged to preserve the filibuster, while a half dozen said they would like to see the rule changed or nixed. By later Wednesday, Trump did something he rarely does. He backed off. He said in an interview on Fox News that while he had no doubt in his mind that his party should get rid of the filibuster, quote, a number of Republicans don't agree, end quote. Speaking in Miami, he mused out loud over whether it would be worth pushing GOP senators to a breaking point to get what he wanted. So I want to lose my relationship with those Republicans that have been very good to me for a long period of time, that voted against the crooked Democrats on impeachment and everything else? Trump asked. Do I want to lose them over it? I think it's a very important point, he said. You ever have people that are wrong, but you can't convince them? So do you destroy your whole relationship with them or not? He said. Senate Republicans have bucked Trump very rarely. Sometimes they've disagreed with his trade or foreign policy positions or nominees, raising concerns in private and occasionally in public. Republican opposition, for example, recently sank Paul Ingrassia, Trump's pick to lead a White House ethics watchdog office, following a report that he made racist and anti-Semitic comments in a text chain. And a handful of Republican senators voted with Democrats multiple times last week to approve measures that would block Trump's tariffs, though the votes fell far short of veto-proof supermajorities. Still, when Trump decides to throw his weight behind a controversial nominee or ambitious legislative effort, he usually gets his way. To push his massive tax bill over the finish line, despite narrow margins in the House and Senate, for example, Trump had to corral the votes of hardline conservatives who had never raised the country's debt ceiling before. They raised it by $5 trillion. The IRS is ending its experiment with free tax filing program by Richard Rubin. The Internal Revenue Service is officially ending Direct File, the free government-run tax filing pilot program the Biden administration started last year. Instead, the Trump administration will promote alternatives for taxpayers to file returns for free through private companies. And we have better alternatives, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who's also the acting IRS commissioner, told reporters on Wednesday. It wasn't used very much, and we think the private sector can do a better job. The IRS debuted Direct File in early 2024. The idea was to give taxpayers something beyond basic forms that looked more like a question and answer tax preparation software that people can buy through H&R Block or Intuit's TurboTax. According to a new Treasury Department report, fewer than 300,000 people used it this year. That was more than double the previous year, but still less than 0.5% of individual income tax returns. The Treasury report said the IRS spent at least $41 million on the program for this year. Democrats criticized the decision. If an opportunity presents itself to stick it to working people and drive up their costs for the benefit of giant corporations, you can count on the Trump administration to seize it, Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, said on Thursday. The Treasury Department and IRS now will focus on building support for Free File, a program that gives most taxpayers access to free commercial tax preparation software. Looking at a short piece on the economics behind Mom Donnie's biggest plans, a millionaire's tax, $4 billion estimated revenue a year, according to Mom Donnie campaign. Pro, the top 1% just received a $1 trillion federal tax cut. It's only fair they now pay a little bit more to make New York City affordable, said Nathan Gusdorf, executive director of the state policy think tank Fiscal Policy Institute. An October analysis it conducted of new 2023 state tax data showed there was no significant increase in high earners leaving New York after the state in 2021 increased its highest personal income tax rates. And con, the tax could prompt the wealthy to leave, said E.J. McMahon of the Manhattan Institute. It is a gilded invitation to second-guess your presence in New York if you're free to go. He added it's risky to rely on revenue from high earners, given the volatility of capital gains and related investment income, and said the hike could contribute to an erosion in recent years in New York's share of millionaires. Mamdani has said revenue from the tax would help pay for programs like universal child care and make the city's personal income tax system fairer. Imposing the tax requires the sign-off of the state legislature and the governor. He more recently has said he is open to other sources of revenue. New York City's personal income tax system is relatively flat, but New York State's income tax regime is more progressive than average, according to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, with the state's top 1% income earners subject to a 13.5% tax. Mamdani's proposal would make the combined city and state personal income tax rate for the highest in the country for those earning a little over $1 million, according to E.J. McMahon of the Manhattan Institute. It is unclear whether this change would raise the revenue that Mamdani's campaign has estimated. It would have brought in an additional $3.74 billion and $2.77 billion in 2021 and 2022 based on the most recent tax data available from the New York City Independent Budget Office. But those estimates assume that married couples filing jointly are subject to the tax hike, which effectively could lower the income threshold for those subject to the hike. Mamdani's campaign hasn't specified which category or categories of filers its hike would affect. Looking at the opinion pages, under review and outlook, Democrats don't mind your flight delays. Chris Murphy explains why his party wants the shutdown to continue. Most folks on Capitol Hill were optimistic this week about a deal to end the month-long government shutdown, which has accomplished nothing. But behold the cynicism of Democrats who now want to exploit their Tuesday election victories to prolong the dysfunction at the public's expense. I think it would be very strange, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut mused to Axios, if on the heels of the American people having rewarded Democrats for standing up and fighting, we surrendered without getting anything for the people we've been fighting for. Mr. Murphy elaborated to another outlet that a compromise now would damage the Democratic brand. The proles languishing on the tarmac for hours can take heart. Your suffering is an assist to the Democratic brand. You may miss Thanksgiving this year when you see that red canceled notice on the departures board, but rest easy that you helped Democrats stir up their voting base for the 2026 midterms. Democrats are also suddenly nonplussed about lapsing food stamp benefits or government-subsidized preschool. Democrats declare that these are cherished national priorities anytime the GOP suggests reforms for better incentives or the most modest spending restraint. We got about 125,000 people, mamas and babies in Massachusetts, that get food assistance, Senator Elizabeth Warren told the media in 2023 about a potential shutdown. Come on, this is baby formula. We could fill a book with such Democratic laments, but now they don't mind if the programs stop. Meanwhile, the public barely even hears about the shutdown costs for U.S. national security. Some 80% of workers at the agency overseeing the American nuclear stockpile are furloughed, and the Pentagon will surely end up behind on ship maintenance and military training. Yet the Democrats are bloody-minded after the routs in Virginia and New Jersey this week and think they have fresh leverage to extort Republicans to bail out the Affordable Care Act. GOP leader John Thune said Thursday that Republicans are 100% willing to discuss that subject once the government opens. The smart Democratic play would be to open the government and pounce on new GOP midterm fears to try to negotiate a deal on Obamacare. Voters want to check on President Trump's excesses, and this week sent him a signal flare about the soft economy. Alas, Democrats seem determined to misread the lessons, even in victory. More partisan pirouettes and extremism coming right up. There is a time and a place to debate health care, just as there's a time and place to debate energy policy and immigration and education, a man from Connecticut once remarked. But, quote, not when the funding of the federal government and all lives that are impacted by it hang in the balance. Well said by Senator Chris Murphy in 2013. The property tax revolt in Texas. Affordability ruled in Texas elections this week, as it did in higher profile races in New Jersey and Virginia. The difference is that in the Lone Star State, Democrats were on the losing end of the issue. Even in a blue city like Austin, voters rejected property tax hikes and sided with Republicans when presented with a clear choice about the cost of living. 63% of Austin voters shot down a proposal to increase the property tax rate by 20%, which would have raised about $110 million a year in local revenue. Democratic Mayor Kirk Watson campaigned for the increase, as did the city council, where Democrats hold 10 of 11 seats, and the 11th belongs to a Democratic socialist. But property tax bills have risen in recent years, and residents didn't buy the claim that they had to pay more for basic services. The average tax bill for city services in Austin is about $2,124, according to the Texas Public Policy Foundation, up from $973 in 2015. A typical resident might pay another $4,000 a year in school district taxes. Voters approved a 20% increase 5 years ago to expand the transit system and ease traffic as thousands of newcomers moved in. And yet, the city still faces a $33 million deficit going into next year. The rebuke to City Hall led Mayor Watson to call for an audit of government spending, which he might have thought about before seeking a tax hike. Elsewhere in Texas, voters rejected 25 of at least 44 proposals to raise school district taxes, according to the Texas Tribune. Tax tolerance has plummeted in recent years. Voters approved 80% of school district tax hikes from 2006 to 2019. At the state level, voters passed three anti-tax constitutional amendments we told you about last week. No new taxes on estates, no new taxes on securities transactions, and no state tax on realized or unrealized capital gains. Mark them down as more reasons people will keep moving to Texas. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. An opinion by Matthew Continetti. Mr. Continetti is an opinion columnist at the Journal. Trump's GOP is losing independence. Republicans will be tempted to dismiss the 2025 election results. They shouldn't. The case against panic goes like this. GOP voters stay home when President Trump isn't on the ballot. The Democrats' money advantage was overwhelming, and Virginia, New Jersey, California, and New York City are Democratic bastions, shaded navy to midnight blue on election maps. All true, all irrelevant. Republicans enter the midterm cycle shouldering two related burdens: economic dissatisfaction arising from high prices and a revolt among independents. To hold the House and avoid investigations and impeachment, Mr. Trump must come up with an affordability agenda and win back at least some of the independents fleeing his coalition. And he must do so quickly. Excuses don't help. Mr. Trump won't be on the ballot again. The Republican Party must find some way to export his appeal to other candidates. If the Democratic fundraising machine performs this well now, imagine what it will look like in 2026 and 2028. The off-year Democratic wave flooded Republican safe harbors. Democrats flipped at least 13 seats in Virginia's House of Delegates. They plan to use their governing trifecta, control of the governor's mansion and both legislative chambers, to redraw the state's congressional map in their favor. New Jersey Democrats will enjoy their largest assembly majority in 52 years. And Georgia Democrats won two seats on the Public Service Commission, the state's utility board. No Democrat has served on it since 2007. The Georgia result is striking. The issue was high electricity costs, and Republican incumbents paid the price. Inflation hasn't gone away. The annual rate has declined since its June 2022 peak of 9.1%. But 3% inflation is still above the Federal Reserve's 2% target. The reality of high prices hasn't faded. Inflation is cumulative. Every decline in purchasing power makes the next reduction feel worse. Voters notice. According to a CNN exit poll, 55% of New York's voters said the cost of living was the most important issue. Crime was a distant second. In Virginia, 48% of voters said the economy was the most important. Abigail Spanberger won them in a landslide. In New Jersey, taxes, 35%, and the economy, 32%, vied for priority. But Representative Mikey Sherrill's margin on the economy was better than Jack Chattarelli's edge on taxes, and her 85% blowout among the 16% of voters who rated health care most important tipped the scales. Inflation sinks presidencies. Presidents Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, and Biden all struggled to arrest declines in the American standard of living. Mr. Trump finds himself in a similar situation. Immigration and inflation brought him back to the White House. He succeeded in closing the border, but inflation remains stubborn. It has contributed to unhappiness with the country's direction. It is Mr. Trump's worst issue. The president rarely talks affordability. He prefers to announce that inflation is dead and defeated. He points to falling gasoline prices. Yet relief is fleeting. It can't compensate for the rising cost of groceries, housing, and health care. What's more, his policies that restrict the supply of goods and labor, such as tariffs and mass deportations, make the problem worse. So does badgering the Fed to cut rates before inflation is tamed. Mr. Trump could follow the only proven strategy against inflation, Ronald Reagan's approach of stable money and pro-growth fiscal policy. It's working now for Argentina's Javier Milei, but for it to work for Mr. Trump would require him to cease bullying the Fed, lower tariffs on allies, and call for a round of cuts in marginal tax rates combined with spending restraint. That's about as likely as Orhan Mamdani advocating a capital gains tax cut. The Mamdani Democrats are happy to fill the GOP policy vacuum. Rent freezes and free buses may be economic fool's gold, but bad policy beats no policy. Republicans have offered nothing. since passing the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, now known as the Working Families Tax Cut, in July. Mr. Trump's latest proposal abolishing the Senate filibuster is procedural, not substantive. It's going nowhere. The absence of policy initiatives and a record-setting government shutdown lend the impression of an aloof and listless GOP. Independents who have turned against Mr. Trump see little reason to return. Independents were once a key to Republican success. Since 2016, when Mr. Trump won them by 4 percentage points, independents have drifted away from him and his party. He lost independents by 13 points in 2020 and by 3 points in 2024. Republican House candidates haven't fared much better. They lost independents nationally by 12 points in 2018 and 2 points in 2022. As Mr. Trump and Speaker Mike Johnson can attest, Republicans can win without independents. It's just more difficult. To do it, they need to mobilize a GOP-leaning electorate and keep their losses among independents to low single figures. Neither happened on November 4th. Turnout was heavily Democratic, and independents went left. In Virginia, Democrats and independents constituted 69% of the electorate. Ms. Spanberger won 99% of Democrats and 59% of independents. The figures were similar in New Jersey, where Ms. Sherrill won 97% of Democrats and 56% of independents. In California, voters approved Governor Gavin Newsom's gerrymandering referendum by 64% to 36%. Independents backed it by 14 points. California isn't middle America, yet the signs point to a 2026 environment that more closely resembles 2018 than 2002, the last time a president's party held the House in a midterm. Unless some extraordinary event causes Americans to rally behind Mr. Trump, Republicans have 12 months to formulate and advertise a program to reduce costs and convince independents that Democratic radicalism is a greater threat than Republican norm-busting and corruption. The country doesn't wait for parties to get their act together. It chooses the alternative. If Republicans fail, big government populists in both parties will run roughshod over confused and ambivalent incumbents. It won't just be the economy that suffers. America will, too. Looking at business and finance, the EU opens an antitrust probe of NASDAQ by Edith Hancock and Alexander Osipovich. The European Union's antitrust regulator opened an investigation into NASDAQ and Deutsche Börse, two of the world's largest exchange operators, over potential collusion in the derivatives market. The probe centers on a deal struck back in the early dot-com era to cooperate in the Nordic region, including on contracts tied to Nokia, then one of the world's buzziest tech companies. Derivatives are financial contracts whose value is tied to a specific asset, such as a stock, a commodity, or a currency. The European Commission is looking into concerns that entities tied to the two exchange groups might have agreed not to compete for the listing, trading, and clearing of some derivatives, it said Thursday. It will investigate if they allocated demand, coordinated prices, and shared commercially sensitive information. The Commission, the EU's executive arm, carried out unannounced raids at the exchange's premises in September 2024 as it scrutinized their business practices. The escalation into a formal probe raises the risk that NASDAQ and Deutsche Börse would eventually be hit with hefty penalties depending on the ultimate outcome of the investigation. Both exchanges denied wrongdoing. Deutsche Börse shares fell more than 4%. NASDAQ shares closed up 0.7%. Both exchange operators said the probe relates to a cooperation pact dating back to 1999 between Deutsche Börse's Eurex and Helsinki Stock Exchange, now part of NASDAQ. The agreement let Eurex member firms trade Nordic products such as options on Finnish mobile phone maker Nokia, while the Helsinki Exchange helped market Eurex derivatives in the Nordic region, the company said at the time. It came as Eurex was expanding internationally, boosted by its embrace of electronic trading, while many rivals were clinging to old-fashioned trading floors. NASDAQ believes that the cooperation was lawful. It was discussed with the European Commission when it was announced, and no objections were ever raised until after the cooperation had ended, the group said. Deutsche Börse and Eurex said they were engaging with the commission and the pact was intended to boost competition. In particular, it aimed to build deeper liquidity in the respective Nordic derivatives markets and create efficiencies. It provided clear benefits for market participants and was public, a spokesperson said. The parent companies of stock exchanges in Helsinki and Stockholm merged in 2003, forming OMX. NASDAQ closed a deal to buy OMX in 2008. The EU probe is the bloc's latest move against alleged collusion in financial services. In recent years, it has fined major banks for running cartels in government bonds and interest rate derivatives. EU antitrust regulators have also fined U.S. tech giants Apple, Meta Platforms, and Alphabet's Google, fueling trade tensions with Washington and prompting complaints from President Trump. The Saudis lower oil price for Asia in a sign of caution by Julia Petroni. Saudi Arabia sharply reduced the price of its crude for Asian customers, a sign of caution from the world's largest oil exporter, just days after OPEC Plus decided to pause output increases for early next year. State-owned oil giant Saudi Arabian Oil Company, known as Aramco, set the official selling price for December loadings of its flagship Arab light crude oil to Asia at $1 a barrel above the Oman-Dubai average, down from $2.20 in the previous month. The price is seen as a key indicator of the kingdom's outlook on regional demand. Prices for other lighter grades were cut by $1.20 a barrel, while heavier grades saw reductions of $1.40 a barrel. In European trading, Brent crude and West Texas Intermediate were barely changed after settling more than 1% lower than in the previous session, despite growing concerns over weaker demand and excess supply. Aramco also trimmed prices for all grades it sells to U.S. customers by 50 cents compared to November, though it left prices unchanged for the Northwest Europe and the Mediterranean. Earlier this month, the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies decided to increase production by 137 barrels a day in December and to pause further increases during the first quarter of next year. In business and finance, the OpenAI CEO says the U.S. shouldn't bail out AI companies, by Sarah Krauss. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman said the startup doesn't want the federal guarantees for its data centers or a bailout if it fails, laying out what he thinks is the government's role should be in America's AI infrastructure build-out. If we screw up and can't fix it, we should fail, and other companies will continue on doing good work and servicing customers, Altman wrote in a lengthy X post. Altman's post came a day after OpenAI Chief Financial Officer Sarah Friar said at the Wall Street Journal's Tech Live conference that the startup hoped financial institutions and perhaps the federal government would support its efforts by helping to guarantee chip financing. Depreciation rates of AI chips remain uncertain, she said, for making it more expensive for companies to raise the debt needed to buy them. This is where we're looking for an ecosystem of banks, private equity, maybe even governmental, the way as governments can come to bear, she said. The backstop, the guarantee that allows the financing to happen, that can really drop the cost of the financing, but also increase the loan to value, so the amount of debt you can take on top of the equity portion. Friar later posted on LinkedIn that OpenAI isn't seeking a guarantee for its infrastructure commitments, but was talking about a broader framework to support an industry-wide build-out. She said using the term backstop had muddied the point. I was making the point that American strength in technology will come from building real industrial capacity, which requires the private sector and government playing their part, she posted. The U.S. government has been incredibly forward-leaning and has really understood that AI is a national strategic asset. Tech companies are in the throes of an unprecedented build-out of data center infrastructure in the U.S., the scale of which has raised concerns among some investors and industry executives about an AI bubble. Concerns over how quickly tech companies can realize returns from their AI investments sent tremors through the stock market this week. Tech investor and President Trump's AI advisor, David Sachs, Thursday said there would be no federal bailout for AI, though the administration wants to ease constraints on permitting and power generation. Sachs said the administration's goal is rapid infrastructure build-out without increasing consumers' electricity bills. Build-out, not bailout, he indicated on X Thursday. In a related X post, he said, I don't think anyone was actually asking for a bailout. OpenAI has discussed loan guarantees as part of the efforts to build more semiconductor fabrication facilities in the U.S., Altman wrote. The company has publicly proposed that idea in the past to speed the AI infrastructure build-out. The startup has commitments of about $1.4 trillion over the next 8 years. Altman said he expects the company to end the year with more than $20 billion in annualized revenue run rate and to grow to hundreds of billions by 2030. Obviously, this requires continued revenue growth, and each doubling is a lot of work, but we are feeling good about our prospects there, he wrote. Altman said the government should build and own its own AI infrastructure and potentially create a strategic national reserve of computing power. But this should be for the government's benefit, not the benefit of private companies, he wrote. Mm-hmm. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In the short articles in Business Watch, AstraZeneca, strong pipeline boosts revenue. AstraZeneca said revenue grew in the third quarter, boosted by the strength of the pharmaceutical giant's treatments pipeline. The UK company booked a 14% year-on-year increase in third quarter core earnings per share to $2.38 on revenue that climbed to $15.19 billion from $13.57 billion. Analysts had expected core EPS, the company's preferred metric, which strips out exceptional and other one-off items, of $2.31 on sales of $14.78 billion. Must be 2.31, I don't know. According to consensus estimates provided by Visible Alpha, the group said Thursday that it continued to deliver on its strategy of bolstering U.S. operations and growth, which included pricing negotiations with the White House. Risk and investment have to be shared across wealthy countries. It cannot be that U.S. taxpayers will continue footing the bill, Pascal Soriot, chief executive, said. AstraZeneca last month reached an agreement with the Trump administration to lower U.S. drug prices so that they're in line with those in other developed nations. The company previously said it would cut the prices for its drugs sold in the Medicaid program and sell treatments directly to consumers at a discount of up to 80%. The deal would allow the company to avoid tariffs on pharmaceuticals that may result from a White House drug pricing investigation for 3 years, it said. Revenue in the quarter for AstraZeneca's oncology unit, its top business, jumped 19% from the prior year period, it said. AstraZeneca backed its 2025 guidance of high single-digit percentage revenue growth and core EPS growth at a low double-digit percentage, adjusted for currency effects. This is by Billy Gray. Moderna posts loss on fall and vaccine demand. Moderna swung to a loss and logged lower sales in the third quarter as it works to expand its offerings amid weakening demand for its COVID-19 vaccine. The biopharmaceutical company on Thursday posted a loss of $200 million, compared with a profit of $13 million a year earlier. Its quarterly loss came in at 51 cents a share, ahead of an analyst expectations for a loss of $2.12 a share, according to FactSet. Revenue fell 45% to $1.02 billion. Wall Street had modeled $879.6 million. The decline in sales was primarily because of lower COVID-19 vaccine sales, it said. This was by Connor Hart. And from Dominic Chopping, AP Møller - Mærsk, higher volumes offset rate drop. Danish shipping giant AP Møller - Mærsk raised the lower end of its full-year earnings guidance as strong container demand and cost efficiencies counter falling freight rates. Maersk's main shipping business posted a 7% increase in third-quarter freight volumes, buoyed by exports from East Asia, with China the main driver of volume growth, supported by strong demands for technology goods. Imports remain robust in Europe, Africa, Latin America, and West Central Asia, though volumes into North America declined, particularly from China to the U.S., it said. Average freight rates fell 31% across most shipping routes, and costs increased because of the higher volumes, partly offset by lower fuel prices. And Nicholas G. Miller has contributed, the outlook on Ralph Lauren raised after strong sales. Ralph Lauren raised its full-year outlook as it recorded double-digit revenue growth across all its geographic segments. The clothing and apparel company recorded second-quarter net income of $207.5 million, or $3.32 a share, up from $147.9 million, or $2.31 a share, in the prior year period. Adjusted earnings were $3.79 a share. Analysts expected $3.45 a share, according to FactSet. Revenue rose 17% to $2.01 billion, beating Wall Street's expectation of $1.89 billion in North America. Revenue rose 13% in Europe, it increased 22%, and in Asia, it gained 17%. Same store sales rose 13%. The company guided for fiscal 2026 revenue growth of 5 to 7% on a constant currency basis, up from its previous forecast of low to mid-single-digit revenue growth. And another from Nicholas Miller about DuPont. Sales gained in third quarter. DuPont de Nemours recorded higher third quarter sales, authorized $2 billion in stock repurchases, and declared a quarterly dividend of 20 cents a share. The materials and chemicals company third quarter net sales rose 7% to $3.07 billion. Net income from continuing operations was $308 million, or 70 cents a share, down from $453 million, or $1.06 a share, the year prior. Continuing operations exclude its aramids business, which earlier this year it agreed to sell for $1.8 billion to Arkwin. Adjusted earnings were $1.09 a share. DuPont lowered its full-year net sales forecast to $6.84 billion from its previous guidance of $6.87 billion. It said it expects full-year adjusted earnings of $1.66 a share. Back to Dominic Chopping and DHL. The profit is up, but revenue slips. DHL parent Deutsche Post backed its full-year guidance despite expecting a subdued macroeconomic environment ahead. The German logistics company said it was able to offset volatility in trade volumes in the most recent quarter by managing capacity, cost efficiency measures, and price adjustments. It posted third-quarter net profit of 840 million euros, or about $970 million, up from 751 million euros in the year earlier period. Revenue fell 2.3% to 20.13 billion euros. Operating profit grew 7.7% to 1.48 billion euros. The group still expects to report positive earnings development, it said. It targets operating profit of at least 6 billion euros for the year and free cash flow of around 3 billion euros, assuming no further potential escalation in tariffs or trade policies. Joshua Kirby contributes from ArcelorMittal. EU policy expected to lift steelmaker ArcelorMittal, there we go, stock, gained ground after the company said European policy support for the steel industry will boost its business next year and beyond as it targets a stronger bottom line. Amsterdam listed shares in Europe's largest steel producer rose 2.4% on Thursday. Year to date, the stock is up 48%. The stock climbed after the Luxembourg-based steelmaker said it expected a potential increase in earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization of $2.1 billion over the coming years, including $700 million this year and $800 million next. The company pointed to strategic growth projects and recent acquisitions, as well as support from European trade policy. And the last little article in Business Watch from Nicholas Miller is about Tapestry. The owner of Coach raises the outlook. Tapestry reported higher first quarter sales and profit and raised its full year outlook as its Coach brand continues to attract Gen Z customers. The company declared a quarterly dividend of 40 cents a share. It also said it now expected to buy back $1 billion in shares in fiscal 2026, up from its previous forecast of $800 million. The luxury apparel company that owns Coach and Kate Spade posted first quarter net income of $274.8 million, or $1.28 a share, up from $186.6 million, or 79 cents a share, the year prior. Net sales rose 13% to $1.7 billion. It boosted its fiscal 2026 earnings guidance to $5.45 a share to $5.60 a share, up from its previous outlook of $5.30 to $5.45 a share. It also increased its fiscal year revenue guidance to $7.3 billion, up from its previous forecast of $7.2 billion. And in Heard on the Street, Hedge Funds for the Masses by Spencer Jacob. Like airlines or fancy hotels, Wall Street has long had a platinum elite membership tier off limits to the hoi polloi. But is it really worth the money? Now that the velvet rope is being lifted for the middle class to invest their retirement money into private equity and credit funds, the answer mostly seems to be no. They're costly, opaque, and had their heyday when interest rates were super low. Some other alternative investments might finally be worth considering, though. Mutual funds called liquid alts that were supposed to mimic hedge funds boomed for a while, but were expensive and not especially liquid. The last few years have seen the launch of cheaper exchange-traded funds that can be readily bought and sold. They could offer better outcomes at lower cost. The main appeal of alternatives isn't necessarily that these investments will do better. Most people own bonds with the full knowledge that they'll earn less in the long run but make it easier to sleep at night. The fact that alternatives have low correlation with more traditional investments is the big selling point for sophisticated institutions like college endowments. It also isn't a bad feature for ordinary retirement savers who often aren't as hedged as they believe. Take 2022, which was the worst year for a 60-40 stock and bond portfolio since the Great Depression. A managed futures strategy ETF from asset manager DBI returned 22% that year. A similar fund from Simplify Asset Management was only launched that March but gained 10%. The two have expense ratios of 0.85% and 0.75% respectively, a bit more than the average actively managed stock fund. Like gold or real estate, hedge fund-like ETFs finally seem cheap and liquid enough that sprinkling a small amount into your portfolio makes sense. The jury's still out on the other alternatives that may soon be headed for your 401k. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, November 7th issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Dasha. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the Buffalo Criterion, followed at 8 o'clock by the New York Times and at 9 o'clock by Buffalo Spree. Stay with us for these readings and more throughout the day. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,